This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Week in Review on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Azhar Fazuddin.
And I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
Welcome to the show that puts the news and the media in the spotlight. This week, we speak to Indrani Kopal, an award winner at the Cannes Film Festival, and Zan Azli, a local documentary filmmaker, on all things documentaries.
But before that, we have three stories from Asia Calling. Protesters call for an end to international pressure in Myanmar. In India, the heat wave has led to suicides and child trafficking. Meanwhile, the country will legalize child labor.
Around 300 people joined a protest in Rangoon last week to call for an end to international pressure on Myanmar over the Bay of Bengal migrant crisis. In Myanmar, citizens have to ask permission from the police before they can host a demonstration. The protesters often do not get permission and are charged for breaking the law. This group said the official gave them permission. Fu Xinpo reports from the protests.
The protesters chant on their way to Kai San Road in Tamwi in Yangon. They're screaming,
"Those who support Bengali are our enemies. UN should not be biased. We don't want unfair pressure. Rohingya is not in Myanmar. Don't insult to our country. Don't insult to our people. Go away, both people."
All of them are wearing T-shirts that read, "Boat people are not from Myanmar. Stop blaming Myanmar." The United Nations has described the Muslim Rohingya as one of the most persecuted people in the world. Most of them have lived in the Rakhine state in western Myanmar for generations, yet have always been denied citizenship by the government. About 150,000 were pushed into refugee camps after two bouts of vicious ethnic violence in the Rakhine state in 2012. Since then, increasing numbers have been trying to escape by sea to Malaysia, Indonesia and Thailand. Mother of two, Mai Than Tai Ai, says she joined the protests because she cares about her country.
"I want to support my nationalist brothers and sisters. I am concerned that the boat people will settle in this country and will not go back to the country they come from."
The protest has been organised by the Akanese for Golden Pagoda, an umbrella group made up of ultra-nationalist organisations like the Rakhine Youth, the Myanmar National Network and Protect the Arakan People. Organiser Kata Arak.
"We heard that many foreign media are saying that these boat people are from Myanmar. The UN itself is saying that Myanmar should accept Rohingya in our country. But Rohingya are not from Myanmar. They are not included among 135 ethnic groups in our constitution. And today, we want to tell UN and foreign media that there is no Rohingya in this country."
Unlike previous student protests, this one received a police permit. Aisha Calling requested an interview with the police to ask them how they decide which protest is approved, but they refused to comment. But organiser Kata Arak says it's clear this protest is in the government's interests.
"I think the government also wants to show their people that they do not accept Rohingya as their citizens. They officially say there is no Rohingya. We also follow this principle and we explain what we are doing to the police and formally ask for permission. We met their criteria, so we got the permit."
The word Rohingya is controversial in Myanmar, and most of the Burmese language mainstream media never use it. They instead use the word Bengali. For Asia Calling, this report was produced by Phin Zun Po in Yangon.
It's worrying that the Burmese government allowed this nationalistic protest to pass. I mean, if the anti-Muslim riots in 2013 is any indication, there's a possibility that allowing this protest, even if it's democratic, will flare up the negative sentiments.
To me, it's worrying and exhausting that despite decades of international pressure to help the Rohingyas, they're still stateless and have become part of the human trafficking problem in the region, like the recent Boat People report and the mass graves we unearthed in Perlis in Thailand. Moving on to our next story, which takes place in India. More than 1,000 people have died there due to the heat wave. Temperatures have reached 47 degrees Celsius in some parts of the country. The extreme weather has worsened crop harvesting, and this is putting financial pressure on the farmers, which leads to an increase in suicides and child trafficking. Shurya Niazi brings us the story from Madhya Pradesh.
Lal Singh was desperate. Heavy rains and hailstorms had destroyed crop after crop. He fell deeper into debt. He struggled to feed his family.
I took a loan of 60,000 rupees from the bank for constructing a tube well on my dry farmland. I planted chilies and was quite hopeful that I would be in a position to repay the loan after harvesting the crop. But the crop failed. I took another 60,000 rupees from a private moneylender at a high interest rate. But few months later, even the wheat crop was spoiled.
So last August, he had only one choice. He sold his two sons to a shepherd for a year of labor in exchange for rupees 35,000, around $500. His wife says it was a heartbreaking decision.
It was wrong, but we were forced to do this just to stay alive. Otherwise, like many other farmers, we too would have been forced to commit suicide. With no money and no means of sustenance, we were beside ourselves.
8 months later, 12-year-old Sumit and his 11-year-old brother Amit fled from the shepherds and were taken to local shelter. Vishnu Jaiswal is director of the local branch of the group Childline, says they were treated very badly.
Their job was to look after and graze the sheep and other animals. They were often beaten. They were not given even two meals a day. As things became worse, they ran away. There are bruises and cuts on their hands.
They were initially reluctant to return to their family. They were worried about how their parents would react. But when I visited, they were back home. Officials believe there could be many other cases like this of farmers trading their children for money. Rajneesh Srivastava, the district collector of Hardar district, says authorities rescued five children from forced labor in April.
We are not taking such cases lightly. We are trying to find under what circumstances they sold their kids. We fear there could be more children in other camps of shepherds. We can't allow the kids to be abused and trafficked in this way. We'll continue investigation till all the children are rescued.
The governments of most states affected by extreme weather have announced relief packages for farmers. But activists claim the process of delivering relief is taking too long, with authorities still assessing the damage in some regions, and corruption means farmers often see very little financial aid.
It's a sad state when desperation kicks in and one is forced to do something drastic as selling your kids for labor just to survive the extreme weather conditions. I do hope India's government can come up with policies to deal with these crop-related issues. I also read that the kids have been returned to their families after they've escaped, so that's a piece of good news.
Well, Asha, you'd be surprised to know that child trafficking is a normal occurrence in this region. I mean, according to reports, a large number of them are directed to outside Asia, you know, generally from low-income to high-income nations. I mean, in the 60s, there was a mass state-sanctioned adoption of Irish children by American families, many of them illegal. Also in India, an amendment to the country's Child Labour Prohibition Act aims to allow children under 14 to work in family enterprises. That's industries like carpet weaving, BD cigarette rolling, and gem polishing. The Indian government argues that it will help impoverished families earn a living and give children an entrepreneurial spirit. Getting children to work will only be legal if it doesn't interfere with their education and is not hazardous. Jasvinder Sehgal in Rajasthan visits a family business that will benefit from the amendment.
Savira Khan's three daughters are helping her to make bangles. They're walking in front of a hot furnace, which melts the powder used for making natural lac bangles. The children handle many poisonous chemicals, such as crystalline silica dust, and inhale noxious fumes of toxic dusts. Mantasha is the youngest and is only 7 years old. She goes to school when there isn't too much work at home.
Our brother is studying while we are melting the material to make bangles. We get injured often because the furnace is very hot. Our eyes are the worst hurt.
Her older sister, 12-year-old Shazia, says most of her friends also home in family industries.
They do embroidery, cloth dyeing, gem polishing, kite and jewelry. Although many of these are dangerous for their health, their parents force them to work. Children are not interested in working, but their parents force them to do it. It has bad impact on our education. Our money helps our family, but damages our future.
Savira Khan is girl's mother. She gets irritated when I ask her why she lets her children walk so close to the furnace.
Mister, why are you worried about my children? They are my children, and if they earn money for their family, why are you upset? I send them to school every day, and they work in their free time. So what's the issue? Didn't our Prime Minister Modi used to sell tea when he was a child? Now the government is ready to relax the law. So what's your problem?
Child rights activists say the government is reversing several decades of efforts by child rights activists to get children out of work and into school. Vijay Goyal has rescued over 2,000 children from hazardous work in the last 2 years.
It will be extremely difficult to differentiate between hazardous and non-hazardous work. For example, a child is allowed to work in his ancestral agriculture farm, which is termed as a non-hazardous work. But what happens if he gets injured by any of the agriculture equipment, like axe or spade?
But the government argues they are helping children, and the amendments reflect the reality of the country's workforce. Shaina NC is the spokesperson of India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party.
Various such examples, and today if you take even the entertainment industry, you take any of the other programs where there are a lot of children who are under the age of 14 who have immense talent which needs to be applauded as well. I think we're very clear that there are hazardous jobs for children and there are non-hazardous which are monitored by parents.
But child rights activists says that it's this monitoring that they are concerned will not take place. Also, the face of child labor in India is not child actors. It mainly affects the lowest castes, in particular Dalit, Adivasi and Muslim children. They are often forced to work because their family has no alternative. These groups are particularly vulnerable to being trafficked into slavery. Shanta Sinha is a former chairperson of the Commission for the Protection of Child Rights.
It's a very sad day and a very sad day for children of our country. We thought that the amendment to the Child Labour Act would actually end child labour, but it seems it has legalised child labour through back door by allowing children to work at home. But then this kind of help, I think, is no help to the family. If children were all in school, the families would be better off.
For Asia Calling, this is Jasvinder Sehgal in Jaipur, India.
My issue with this is, how does one differentiate between hazardous and non-hazardous work? How do you determine if this kind of family enterprise work doesn't affect the child's education? Because if a 10-year-old is making bracelets 6 hours a day and then she has to go to school afterwards, surely she is physically tired and might not be able to concentrate in classes.
Well, here's where I would apply the same principles of labor rights. If you're not compensating the worker and you're pushing them beyond reasonable limits, it's already wrong.
Did you just compare a child to a worker? I feel like in this story, the lines have been blurred and I can't tell the difference between a child and a worker anymore, which is sad.
Asia Calling was produced by Kantu Berita Radio 68H in Jakarta. And after the break, we listen to Indrani Kopal and Zana Azli sharing their experiences as documentary filmmakers.
Here's a snippet from the report.
It's such an honor when someone let you in in their lives and tell you the deepest secret, the most darkest moment in their lives, and they just open their heart and soul and give you everything that they have so that can change someone else's life. Because I tried sitting in front of camera and I could not even do it. It's really, really... It takes a lot of courage, trust me. So I started appreciating a lot of people who shared their lives with me when camera was pointed at me. You know, it's like it's not an easy thing to do. And those who did share their lives with me, I'd like to thank them today. There are a lot of people just sat in front of me and they have shed tears.
I'm Azif Azuddin.
And I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
You're listening to The Week in Review, BFM 89.9.
Good morning, I'm Aisha Tajuddin and the Week in Review continues. Azif Azuddin will not be joining us for this part of this week's show, but joining me instead is our producer Cheryl Kaur. Hi Cheryl.
Hi Aisha.
So Indrani Kopal is Malaysia's darling. She's recently won an award at the American Pavilion's Emerging Film Showcase in the prestigious Cannes Film Festival. Her documentary, The Game Changer, bagged the Best Student Documentary Award. It's about how dance is used as part of a rehabilitation program at a correctional facility in New York. It's part of her thesis at Hofstra University. So Indrani, what does it feel like to win such a prestigious award?
That's great. I mean, award winning is always a good feeling, right? But it's just that it's completely unexpected. So I'm still digesting the whole what's happening. Because once I close the Facebook, life gets to normal. You know, I still have editing to do. I still have to graduate. I still have so many things to do. After 14 festivals, you really start thinking what's next. Yeah, it's great though, but Cannes trip really changed my life and it's quite remarkable. I never thought I'd be going in the first place, right? So this is, I'm still high from Cannes.
Most people get the impression that it's difficult to enter the Cannes Film Festival. But as Indrani points out, it may be a long process, but it isn't as complicated as you may think.
The film entered the festival circuit last year, sometime March. So the submission started March until May. In fact, I was still submitting films up to July, and I think the last submission went on to October and December. So it's a year-long submission. You pick a festival, and then you meet all the criteria, and then you just submit. But the acceptance started coming in only after August. So, you waited for like about 5 months. There was no news and you'd be wondering, okay, that's it. You're probably not going to do well. And then there comes one from Portland. Portland was our first acceptance and then one, and then it just kept coming in. And you probably accept five. I think we all were excited when the fifth acceptance came in. And then you hit 10. And after that, you thought, okay, this is it. I mean, you shouldn't ask for more. And then came 11, 12, 13. And then came the American Pavilion's acceptance, which is the biggest, I think the most impactful too, because it actually took me to Cannes. And then getting into the short film festival of Cannes, it put the film in the market over there. And so that's big. It was a long process. It didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen in a month or two. It's a year-long process, really. So
Game Changer isn't the filmmaker's first documentary. She's been making them for 6 years and started out with Malaysia Kini's video arm, Kini TV. At the time, she had no idea she was making documentaries. Documentary filmmaking is about capturing moments.
Documentary, to me, is capturing a slice of life. I'm just there as the fly on the wall, and I like to just take my audience into someone's life, and it's like you're opening a window in someone's life and you're just walking in there, you're hiding and you just watch. And sometimes you participate in that process, sometimes you don't. But me telling others what to do, stand here, stand there, and that's just not what I'm terrible at that, actually, really. So no, I'm not really comfortable with that title for director, yeah.
A filmmaker or journalist in pursuing a story cannot run away from forming relationships with their subjects. Some would argue you lose objectivity the moment you get too close.
Unless you bond, you'll never get access to the very intimate details of what's happening in their life. That bonding, that access, that deep, intimate access that you develop with them is what giving you a look in that look into their, not just the surface of their life, but also what's happening deep inside. Their emotional struggle, you know, their demons, they sometimes share them with you. And what I'm doing also is I'm experimenting something else. I'm actually giving this man, all those men, camera. They have a small camcorder with them. And I asked them to flip the camera onto themselves and actually to record a video diary every night, if possible, if not once a week. Just share whatever they want to share. Talk to the camera on their own time, in their own time. And I believe camera has a power to actually bring out certain truth that we, in a conversation or in an interview session, can't do. And I was interested in that truth. I was interested to see what will come out of them if I'm not there, if they themselves share something, you know, because they do have different lives than ours and they have different experience. 20 years being inside or 13 years being inside, it's just, you know, a whole chunk of life been taken away from you and coming back to a life that you once knew. It's a very different process. It's a very different integration itself, a very organic process. And I was very interested in the process, not only what I'm asking them, but also what they feel inside. And I thought they would share differently if they were to do a video diary. And it's an experiment. Like I said, it's not a very successful experiment so far because some of them are still very shy to talk. Some of them very, you know, they're feeling really intimidated sometimes, but they're trying. And that's the important part. I told them, this is not just my film. This particular second sequel will be a collaborative piece. It's going to be all our films because I'm going to use Susan's home video. I'm going to use this video diary this man are actually trying to make. They're trying hard, really. And then the interviews that I've done with them. So it'll be a combination of all these three different. You know, it's a mess, but I know something is going to come out of it. And I've never done this before, so it is an experiment, yeah. So that's the beauty of documentary. I get to do this, you know. And whether it works or not, end of the day, it's a process that matters, right? The journey that matters, so.
Documentary filmmaking isn't easy. It's challenging, especially when it comes to managing your characters, storyline, and logistics. Just about anything could become an obstacle to a good film. Funding is usually the biggest stumbling block. The Game Changer costs $3,000 to make, a large sum of it coming from independent funding.
The challenge always has been the monetary issue for me, funding. Being a student, having a partial, scholarship really helped me to even to get started the whole project, right? I mean, I went to US with the scholarship, the Fulbright scholarship, and thanks to US Embassy even to send me to Cannes. But the making of the documentary is always the funding has always been the big thing. And I wish, like any other Ivy League schools, I have this huge crew to work with, right? No, I don't. And I'm not from United States. I don't have the kind of resources or to do crowdfunding even. I don't have people to source such the kind of money to do my projects. So it's really personal funding or whatever I could raise and generous contribution from friends and colleagues. And, you know, they say, okay, one day I'll shoot for you, shoot for me. And I have equipments from the school and I have an editing machine myself. I mean, I have a laptop and I edit, thank God, you know, so I don't really need much. So it didn't take much to do this. End of the day, I know the strength is in my story.
Today, Indrani has over 10 documentaries and short films under her belt. One of her more notable ones is a documentary of the plight of the underrepresented transgender community in Malaysia.
She's My Son. That's my first documentary that I made for Comas in 2007. That video, after completing She's My Son in 2007 for Comas, I knew that that's exactly what I want to be. I want to be a documentary filmmaker. That process of finishing She's My Son really transformed me because before that, for a year plus, I was working at Malaysia Kini. I was doing news features. I was doing videos. And, you know, it's a job and I loved video. My strength has always been in visual. So it's, it was great. It was nice. It was challenging and everything. And then you really get sucked into this journalism point. I'm trying to make an objective piece and everything. And what happened is, it's a departure from news for me. I went into a real documentary process, which was very different than journalism. So that's when I actually started dividing that. It's like, okay, there's a line between, you know, my news piece, my news features, to a documentary piece where I don't have to be objective. I don't have to try to be trying to be objective. I can make a point, I can take a stand, and I can just tell them what I want.
The ability to peel away someone's layers to reveal their desires, fears, and most of all, secrets. That's among the things Indrani finds most rewarding.
It's such an honor when someone let you in in their lives and tell you the deepest secret, the most darkest moment in their lives, and they just open their heart and soul and give you everything that they have, so that can change someone else's life. Because I tried sitting in front of camera and I could not even do it. It's really, really, it takes a lot of courage, trust me. So I started appreciating a lot of people who shared their lives with me when camera was pointed at me, you know. It's like, it's not an easy thing to do. And those who did share their lives with me, I'd like to thank them today. There are a lot of people just sat in front of me and they have shed tears. And they told me their most, you know, the most vulnerable stories, and they showed their most vulnerable self to me. And to me, that's an honor, really, and I appreciate that. It's different, you know, it does something to you, really. You go through a lot. You go through an internal process. On top of it, you actually have to tell them something. And sometimes it's hard to lie. You know, people tell you, people can pull up an act, but you can't hold the act too long in front of camera. That's what it does. If you hold the camera long, if you point a camera long enough onto somebody, you cannot hold a fake emotion that long. The truth does come out. Something will come out of you. I think that's also a theory, right? And the Chronicles of the Summer, that was an experiment that Don Roos did. You know, can people lie in front of camera when you really ask them all the intimate questions? And something else happens when you point a camera at somebody, and I'm interested in that process.
With more than a decade of experience, Zan Azli, a senior editor at Astro Awani, has seen it all. Here's how he started out in the local documentary scene.
I don't know much about the technical history of documentaries in Malaysia, but I do know when I first started making documentaries way back in the early 2000s, it was 2002, 2003, I started making short documentary films independently on my own, guerrilla style. There were not that many independent documentary filmmakers around. Basically, there were a lot of TV documentaries on TV, on RTM, on TV3, and of course we had the Discovery Channels and the National Geographics and all that. And although I was interested in those kind of documentaries, what really interested me was more exploratory or experimental documentaries or non-fiction films. So that was how I got started. There were not that many back then. There was Amir Muhammad, who made The Big Duria, where he made a series of short films called Six Shots, which were all non-fiction video essays, and they ranged between, 5 minutes to 10 minutes long. And I saw that series, saw it at the old actor studio down in Dataran Merdeka. And I watched it, and I thought, it was very inspiring, and it made me feel like, you know, if Amir Muhammad can do something like that, probably anybody can do something like that too. So I started making films. And slowly, as the years went by, you know, more people got interested into documentary filmmaking. And there were more, I guess, independent documentary filmmakers who started making more experimental non-fiction films. People like Ku Eng Yao, people like Ahmad Yazid and Lydia Lubon, they started making documentaries. And I guess now it is quite vibrant, you know, quite vibrant. Some of the people I know who started out making, you know, these kind of documentary films with me have also gone into TV. Like, for example, Ahmad Yazid, he does a lot of documentary programs for Astro, for Discovery, for the History Channel, things like that. And maybe now I would say there are not that many anymore independent documentary filmmakers, or maybe because I haven't been around.
So is there a demand for documentary filmmaking in Malaysia?
I think there is a demand. People want to watch real stories. And because of that demand, I think, yes, it's being produced, especially for TV. I'm not too sure about online. Online, yeah, maybe. You know, you have videos that are coming out on websites like Postcode, you know. They are making like very Vice-like kind of documentary-style videos online. And it's very interesting to watch. So, yes, I think there is a demand for it.
Zan also explains the challenges faced by documentary filmmakers in our country, particularly how hard it is to make a living off documentary filmmaking.
I guess trying to sell their documentaries and trying to make money. Because if you want to make money from your documentaries, you probably have to go more commercial route and sell it to TV and all that. And when you sell it to TV, they require a certain format and certain style, which, you know, as a documentary filmmaker who might want to try to be original and try to create something new, might not be too ideal, you know, unless that is the kind of commercial documentaries that is, if that is the kind that you want to do, then that's great. But if not, you know, you might find a little bit of difficulty trying to get people to pay for it. You know, you can start your own channel, you can go online, start your own website and go on YouTube and things like that, but it's highly unlikely that you're going to get a lot of hits that you can actually make a living out of, you know, YouTube ads or something, you know. So that is probably one of the main challenges. I know some people want to say censorship would probably be another challenge, but, you know, in this day and age, people are brave enough to say anything, so I don't really see that as a challenge. I guess it's a sustainable issue if it's more of a challenge.
So is the local scene accommodating?
The TV scene, yes, it creates quite a conducive environment for documentaries, but film itself, probably not, because, you know, in Malaysia, we have never seen a Malaysian documentary film shown in the cinemas, for example. You know, and a lot of people, when they go to cinema and they talk about film and they watch film, they always think about fiction, narrative fiction films. They never think about documentaries. Whereas there are a lot of feature documentary films being screened elsewhere around the world. You know, documentary filmmakers like Errol Morris, Ross McElwee, they make a very cinematic style kind of documentary films. And we don't get to watch those in cinemas here in Malaysia. So if you start bringing these films in, maybe it can encourage people to make more films, more documentary films that are well-suited for the cinema.
There are a lot of avenues for formal documentary filmmaking courses in Malaysia. Zan, however, says students tend to romanticise the idea of filmmaking, hence preferring fiction.
Somehow, you know, in Malaysia, it's people who go into filmmaking, it's very romanticised. They always want to make these, you know, fiction films, you know, that will be shown in the cinemas and, you know, glamour, red carpet kind of thing. So documentaries probably takes a backseat, like, especially for those who are studying in university and colleges and they want to, you know, make filmmaking a career. They don't normally look at documentaries. They always look at the more glamorous fiction films.
Indrani, what would you say to anyone who's keen in pursuing documentary filmmaking?
Watch documentaries. I think you have to start by watching documentaries, that learning that. What is it about documentary that interests you? To me, what interests me was the real lives, real stories, real people. When I can bring out an emotion and move and change and transform using real life stories, you know, I realized that ordinary people are walking up and down out there with extraordinary stories. I just have to find the right people, people willing to share. And I have an amazing story to tell and share. You know, people always want to share. They're looking for good storytellers who can... People want to share their stories. There's just nobody there to listen. So if you can sit and ask your friend, what's your story, and tell me what's going on with you, if you can sit there for half an hour and listen to that person's story and without interrupting, you're a storyteller because you're listening. You have to be interested in someone else's story. How many of us would rush and want to tell our own story every time? The act of listening, the art of listening someone else's story and really genuinely interested in their story and wanted to share their story because they moved you is an internal process that you have to realize that you have it and you want to do it. I think that's an organic process of becoming a documentary filmmaker.
Many say that winning the Cannes means that you've arrived, you're at your peak, but Indrani disagrees.
You know, everybody thinks what's next as though this is like my pinnacle. This is my beginning. This is my first step. I just started. 6 years, 7 years was just a training. I just started. I just came out. So my journey is just about to begin and I'm not ready to leave production yet. So I am going to struggle. I'm not going to be a millionaire by 40. I'm going to be this poor, famous filmmaker maybe, but end of the day, I just want to go on and tell stories and hopefully pay bills at the same time. And, you know, that's a bad combination. That's a rare combination. I don't know. So I'm just going to just go with the flow. One step at a time. So first thing is I want to go back and finish my project and come back, see what's waiting for me.
What are the consistent themes you take on in your documentaries?
All these years and also my work in US, there's this theme. And I think it's called hope and inspiration. Because I think it's easy to bring about change when you can instill hope, when you can inspire. And I noticed that in Like, it's like a thread that, you know, kept all my stories. There's always a hope. I always end it with hope, or there's always a light at the end of the tunnel. Some stories are really difficult. They're like, oh my God, you know, you just so much emotions. But in the end, I realized that I always ended with the light, with that hope.
Indrani has a sequel in the works. It's called The Incarcerated Rhythm and will focus on the same dancers and their lives after the curtains close. Will dance help them integrate into society? Will it be a successful part of the rehabilitation program?
She will return to Malaysia in September this year after she completes her Fulbright scholarship. We'll look forward to watching how her career unfolds.
The local documentary scene in Malaysia, however, hasn't quite hit the big time yet, at least in terms of viewership. We still find people gravitating towards the mainstream.
After all, how many of us really do watch documentaries on a regular basis? With prominence thanks to people like Indrani winning an award, could this spur more interest in documentaries? Only time will tell. That's all we have for you this morning. I hope this morning's show has been food for thought.
And remember, the price for liberty is eternal vigilance. This has been The Week in Review. I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
And I'm Cheryl Cole.
BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.